Hi, my name is Dave Page, and you are tuning in to another edition of the FizDab Podcasts. We're going to discuss some research today. I'm here with
Josh Salzman, Director of the Critical Care Research Center at Regents Hospital in St. Paul.
Dr. Keith Wesley, I'm the Medical Director of Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul.
First up today, we're going to talk about a paper that appeared in Respiratory Care. It's actually in press as we speak. It was published July 6, 2012. And its false positive rate of carbon monoxide saturation by pulse oximetry of emergency department patients. It was done by a group out of Utah led by Dr. Weaver, Dr. Churchill, and a couple of other folks. And I'll briefly describe the methods of this paper and sort of what their overall 10,000-foot view is. I do want to disclose that this same group reviewed RAD-57 carbon monoximetry paper that had been published a little while ago. You can click on the link on the website, but we were very curious about that at that time. This will appear in the August GEMS Journal of Emergency Medical Services in the research column, and the link to the commentary before is there as well. So, having said that, in this case, this particular project actually cleaned up some of the problems that we had before, and I'm very curious to hear Dr. Wesley's commentary on this one. So, they took a sample of convenience coming into the emergency department, trained three raters, if you will, to use the RAD-57 carbon monoximeter, and between April and August of 2008, they anybody who was getting a blood draw in this emergency department got a RAD-57 reading to measure their CO levels. Then they compared the blood draw to the RAD-57 reading and tried to see if the ratings were comparable. There's 1,363 patients in this sample, about 613 male, and 1,141 were light-skinned. So that was a big complaint we had before in our previous commentary, was that the previous paper had really not disclosed. We know that skin tone actually affects the reading of the RAD-57, and we were displeased by that. We were also, I want to say that the readings were taken simultaneously, which was another complaint we had, and they were sent to multiple labs, which was another complaint we had. So in this paper, they were taken simultaneously, and they were sent to the same single machine to get the readings, the blood CO readings. So what is their conclusion? Well, they really found that there was at least there's some correlation. So first of all, that's kind of interesting. The RAD-57 readings were a little bit higher in some cases and a little bit lower in other cases. And their big kind of splash conclusion is that because there were some false negatives, that the RAD-57 really should not be used as a triage tool. So big thumbs down from this paper about using a RAD-57 to use it as a field triage. Now we're going to get into the numbers here in a minute to actually look at how many patients they're basing this conclusion off of. And we can open it up for discussion now.
Well, and just a slight correction, Dave, their statistical answer was that it had too high a false positive rate.
Oh,
it
right.
It trended
right.
towards potentially having too high a false negative rate, but their numbers weren't sufficient sufficiently powered to show that. But it did trend to that. And they did recount three or four cases of patients with abdominal pain and psychiatric conditions that were found to have significant CO levels as high as 20 when their co-oximetry came back within the normal.
That's the crux of the problem is they had three patients in which this occurred,
right?
And so based on that, the fact that the RAD 57, two of them read zero,
right,
and then end up having a CO levels of above 10. So that's a big deal.
And we
deal.
Talked about that with the previous studies, that if you get a reading of zero using co-oximetry, then there's something technologically wrong. Because what is interesting that they found, and I think maybe they were a little surprised, being that this was in Murray, Utah, that even their non-smokers had an average carboxyhemoglobin of somewhere between 2.5% and 3%. Well, Murray, Utah is a middle of an industrialized suburban area in the Utah Valley. And so very similar to what you would see in a suburb around Denver. They have inversion levels, layers in industrial areas, and non-smokers are known to have. That's what you're resting. Those guys out there running their marathons along the freeway are sucking fumes and have carboxyhemoglobins of 3. And so then their smokers, of course, had higher. So one of my first critiques with them is that they artificially determined that a positive for a non-smoker would be anything over zero, when that's not correct. Truly should be anything over 3. And I think that they did break it down to that. But then they said a false positive for smokers would be over 6. Well, again, that's probably too low a level as there. Did they say 10, Josh? Did you look at that?
No, they used 6.
They used 6, which is probably too low of an indicator for a smoker. The thing they didn't also provide us is the methemoglobin levels. What did the RAD 57 give them for CO and met? And we know that the patient who puts their cigarette out as they come into the ER is going to initially show an elevated carboxyhemoglobin, but their methemoglobin level is not going to be elevated. And so if you base it again on that without correlating it with a methemoglobin, you're going to have false positives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really interested in this whole conversation about, and we've had it before, specificity
sensitivity.
And whether or not these devices are actually going to be helpful or not. To be fair to the paper, they do say that the device performed within the parameters of the manufacturer and list that as a 3%. But that's not necessarily 3 percentage points of CO. That's a 3% margin of error. And they explain that very well. So they do say that the device actually does what it's supposed to do, but it was likely to underestimate carboxyhemoglobin and my beef with the problem, as you said, is the issue of zeros, which rears its ugly head here again, and I continue to see zeros in the field, but I also have learned from your teaching that if you don't see a pleth, you're not really getting the reading.
That's correct.
So now when you look for the pleth, and presumably they only had 3 people doing this, these people were well-trained and should have known that and probably...
And they seem to have a good algorithm for... now, they didn't mention whether they were using the dominant hand or the non-dominant hand, and Massimo in their insert makes it important that you use the dominant hand because supposedly the blood flow is supposed to be superior to the dominant hand. But they used one finger, and if it didn't work on that finger, they'd go to the next finger. They didn't go to the other hand, so I'm assuming that they were talking about using multiple fingers on the dominant hand. But you're right. I mean, zeros just don't make any sense. You shouldn't get a zero. What was that patient? What were the patient population like with the zeros? Did they have peripheral vascular disease, peripheral neuropathies? Did these people have, rheumatoid arthritis, things that would potentially compromise their small vessel circulation?
I also found the discussion around heat being a potential problem for accuracy being very interesting, since we're talking about, you know, the real sort of at least marketing push for this device is during, you know, especially for use for firefighters who are coming out of a fire and presumably exposed to all sorts of fumes. So then you wonder, well, they're going to be really hot. And if temperature is going to affect the readings, then we really need a controlled study that looks at, you know, what this would look like with people. Plus, it wasn't randomized. It's a sample of convenience at the end of the day.
So I kind of, my beef with this, not necessarily isn't with the study, but with the device in and of itself, or having a device, not necessarily this device, but having a device that measures carbon monoxide in the blood. So from my perspective, the way that I look at it is that you should be able to have a very good history and physical exam that's going to tell you if somebody's been exposed to carbon monoxide or not. I think it's safe to assume that if a firefighter is inside working a structure fire, that they're going to be exposed to some level of carbon monoxide. If they come out, they're tired, they're nauseated, you know, they have a headache. Sure, it could probably be exposure to heat and maybe some dehydration, but I think it's also safe to assume that they've been exposed to some level of carbon monoxide. Now, whether it's treatable or not, then that firefighter should be taken out for observation and potentially transported anyways. So I guess I just don't see any value in continuing to try and market a device that may or may not work.
Ouch, let the letters begin.
Well, I think it's a good cautionary tale for people to keep in mind that every device that's an indirect measure of some value is obviously going to have a range of error. And our experience with the device, we've done some work in firefighting during the overhaul phase and doing some readings with folks, and it's incredibly difficult to get a good reading on. We found that it's just not a device that you can slap on and get a reading on somebody reliably. We know that these people were exposed to some level of CO because they weren't wearing their face mask, and they're still coming back with readings of zero. So it's just, I think, a cautionary tale that it's not a silver bullet, and it may be something that can help from a screening perspective, but then as the provider, you need to use good clinical judgment in addition to what the reading is coming out as.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that from a design perspective, they did a pretty decent job in putting their trial together, as well as the statistical analysis that they performed, is at a level that I think it sometimes we lack in the articles that we actually review. So I think they were thoughtful about how to analyze the data and used good methodology, but you know, there's always restrictions with what you can possibly do. So I think they should be recognized for at least having a good plan and being thoughtful about how they plan their regression modeling, which can be difficult for people to understand and know how to do the right way if they don't do it frequently.
I think they did a great job. You know, I mean, I'll be the cheerleader for just research in general, because to attempt this again is great, even if it's just a sample of convenience. But there were 1,300 patients in this sample.
Yep.
That's a large number of patients who had blood draws and also had a reading. And that's a lot of, you know, tracking and making sure that you get the right results back. And if out of 1,300 we had just a few that came out as zeros, that means that that's, you know, very few. It's more the matter of the lower than normal readings, and that's, you know, really the question. I think you put a device in anybody's hand and suddenly, you know, it's the technological imperative. They have to use the device.
Yeah.
And then what are you going to do when it says zeros, you know, or low numbers? You may make the mistake of thinking, well, that really does just, there's no problem. Your headache is just a headache. And I think the authors are really savvy and kind of going, this might not be a good field triage tool. We might need to find a different way. I do remember, though, if you remember the discussions about when pulse oximetry came out, it was the same story. People didn't trust it. People thought it was really, you know, completely wacky. And they thought, you know, I'm not going to pay attention to that number. Your nail polish could throw it off. Your, if you're a smoker, it'll throw it off. If you're at altitude, it'll throw it off. And there's such a little range. And I think over time that tool, we learned to use that tool differently. And now the tool is somewhat useful. And everybody talks about, well, what was their SpO2 reading? So maybe we're in the infancy of CO monitoring, and as we get better and the sensors get better and the clinicians get better at getting the readings, the readings will become more useful, and it'll be the same old story.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I do want to correct something I did say earlier, that they didn't include their methemoglobin scores, but they actually did. And if anything, it's actually in Table 3 of the study. If they had looked at the methemoglobin levels, that would have helped them understand it actually makes it a little more confusing. The thing is with patients, there are a host of disease conditions which will promote methemoglobinemia, and the CO is not the only one. And so a patient's methemoglobin can go up, and that's probably related to some of the false positives, because they actually relate that in their results, that the three most common denominators for false positives was the presence of methemoglobinemia, hypotension, and women. And body temperature.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, so... I was looking for the numbers, whether that was fever, and I would expect it's probably fever, that the patients with fever had abnormal. Because, again, the perfusion is maybe much higher, and that's not what the device is calibrated for. Or maybe it was hypothermia. But, I like Marshall said, I think that, and what's important for our, we've been using the word RAD57, and that's what this, of course, the study talks about. But we recognize that the new Zoll monitors and life and the physio monitors, the co-oximetry technology is the very same. There's only one maker currently using co-oximetry that I'm aware of in the devices that predominate out there. I think there are some other makers out there that measure carboxyhemoglobin, but not using the patented rainbow technology, I believe it's called, from Masimo. And so, again, this is not to incriminate Masimo. This is new technology. But it may be technology looking for a niche rather than a niche that needs technology to fill it. And that's probably my biggest concern, because at the end of the day, it all comes down to what does the patient look like, what's the differential diagnosis, and start the workup from there. And the concept of a screening tool is something that should have great ability for me to safely walk away from that patient without the suspicion that they could have a life-threatening condition. And, I mean, that's just like doing 12 leads in the field. We wouldn't do a 12 lead, get a normal 12 lead on a patient, sweating bullets, and it shows no ST elevation, and sign them out. It's great when it's positive, but it's lousy when it's non-diagnostic. And we have to just rest on our
I think that
professional
you
judgment.
Hit the nail on the head there. You know, it really is about that. It can be used to rule people in, but maybe not rule people out. And I think the same, you know, I think you'll appreciate this even more. It's the same story as end-tidal CO2. Early on with end-tidal CO2, people looked at it and said, "Bah, that's just a bunch of numbers. What are you going to do with it? You know, treat the patient. If the patient's sick, you know, you treat the patient." And then we learned a lot more about what those numbers were telling us about, you know, perfusion and metabolism and respirations. And so then suddenly the tool became a lot more useful.
And yet useful in the sense that it made us more comfortable and confident in our underlying primary impression and therapy.
Yes.
Not, I didn't even think about that, and gosh, now I ought to. So You know, and I think that's the same way with technology. Even when pulse oximetry first came out, it just, you know, it was so inexpensive. Everybody had it, and yet there was no data that the number that you got changed whether or not the patient was hypoxic or in respiratory stress or how you treated them.
Yeah. Great. On that note, thank you for tuning in to another edition of these podcasts, and we'll see you later.